Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have you all joining us again this week. We've had a recording hiatus where we've been off, giving Sam a chance to move across several, or at least one state line, if not two. Sam, how's it going there in Colorado now?
It's awesome in Colorado. I love it here. It's beautiful. Even though the first day I was here, we had this horrendous storm, so people were accusing me of bringing the El Nino with me. But, you know, it's still cold. I'll get used to that. But it's absolutely gorgeous. I look out my window and look at the Rockies. So I have to use high altitude directions to bake a cake now. So I got to kind of get used to that. But it's well worth it. As much of a hassle as the move was, I'm glad I'm here. I love where I am. It's great having family nearby, and it's awesome. It was well worth the effort. So, Joe, I hear it's cold down your way, too, down in Memphis.
It's a little cold down in Memphis. Nothing compared to Denver. I was just actually out there last week for some training session, and it was 7 degrees and 6 inches of snow on the ground. So,
yep, you caught it right after the storm, and it's ironic you were so close but so far away. You were an hour away or so from me. Well, we have a special guest tonight. Well, Jamie, first of all, though, did you have any news items or any words of wisdom or anything
since we've the three of us have talked, I've had a blizzard.
Your personal blizzard?
Yeah, here on the East Coast, we got hit, and we actually hunkered down for 3 days. The snow started Friday. The state of emergency started on Saturday morning early, where you weren't allowed out on the roads, and they didn't clear our development. We had 3 feet of snow in the road until Monday evening.
Wow.
So they didn't get to clear our development out until Monday night. You know, that's a solid three days. We were kind of, you know, in the house, and I had the driveway plowed and snowblowed out, and that was good enough. But, you know, we couldn't get anywhere because the road wasn't clear and to get out of our development. And you know, we were prepared. We kind of knew this was coming. There was plenty of advance warning. You know, the National Guard was activated, so the Humvees and the big vehicles were out to get emergency responders to where they needed to be, and they were picking up nurses and ferrying them back and forth to the hospital, along with nurses and doctors and other key personnel, as well as picking up paramedics for their shifts and taking the ones that are going off shift home. Over those 3 days, because we weren't the only development that was late getting plowed out. There was so much snow that the regular plows couldn't handle it. You know, the plows we have for our Mid-Atlantic region, a lot of times we just have large pickup trucks with plows on them, and they just couldn't move the snow. Yeah. So we had to actually wait until a front end loader could get in here and scoop the snow out, shovel full at a time.
Wow. Yeah, we had the same thing here because my brother said, oh, yeah, the condos association is really good about, you know, because I have a long driveway that goes into my place, and it wasn't plowed, and I actually got stuck in it my first day, even though I was in four-wheel drive. So you know how we talk about how little water it takes to, you know, cripple a car? Well, I learned about even a couple feet of snow can create big problems, and you can get stuck in it. So my brother had to come over and shovel me out.
And it's a lesson, I think, you know, just we've talked about preparedness, personal preparedness before on the show. And it's just that lesson of it's going to take 3 or 4 days in a major incident for authorities to get everybody cleared out and attended to. And this was an example of that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was an expected snowfall, but it was unprecedented to the effect that we didn't have the equipment to deal with it once it was all said and done. And that was affecting a rather large area from Washington, D.C. up to New York City. So it's something, you know, again, we talk about preparedness. It can be any kind of major event like that, as Joe will attest to, as you can attest to, Sam. Any kind of major event that strikes your region, you need to be prepared for 3 to 4 days of self-sufficiency.
Yep, and I totally agree. And now I just got to kind of change my mindset from rain to snow and remember all of the issues around snow. But I'm learning as we go. So I'm anxious to find out where our guest is from. We could find out what's going on in her part of the world. We have an exciting guest today. Joe, I'll let you introduce her since you met up with her in Denver here recently and kind of talked her into coming onto the podcast.
Sure. Well, Lori's been part of the FEMA incident support team. Actually, I guess the primary veterinarian in the system for a long time. And I did get a chance to see her and catch up with her last week out in Denver at a FEMA training session. And she had some really interesting work that she'd been doing on some of the injuries that we see in our task force canines. But I asked her to come on to talk not only about that, but just kind of veterinary-related issues in general from a disaster standpoint. We've talked about animals and all that sort of stuff before, and I thought Lori would be the perfect one to talk about that. So, Lori, say hello and tell us a little more about yourself.
Hello. Sure. My name is Lori Gordon. I've been a veterinarian since 1989, and I actually have a traveling surgical service, so I do surgery for various hospitals. I live in very southern New Hampshire, a town called Atkinson. And I serve at several hospitals in the southern New Hampshire and northern Massachusetts region. So they subcontract me to do surgery for them. I actually first learned about urban search and rescue teams when I deployed to the World Trade Center. I deployed with the VMAT team, which is the Veterinary Medical Assistance Team. Learned about urban search and rescue and joined the Massachusetts Task Force 1. Our team in 2002 and have been with them ever since. There's technically no position for a veterinarian on these teams. There's no rostered position, which means automatic deployed position. But my task force leader, Mark Foster, was very interested in having a veterinarian, so he encouraged me to continue in the system. And eventually, working through the very fascinating world of FEMA politics. I got a veterinary position approved in Washington. So that allowed veterinarians the same liability, workman's comp, and license to practice outside their state during emergency as the medics and paramedics when we deploy to another state or another region. So that was very exciting.
That's very cool. Yeah.
It's good. I first, after the World Trade Center, we had a couple of published publications on the injuries and illnesses that the search dogs incurred there by other people, Dr. Cindy Otto and Dr. Phil Fox. And then Dr. Duchame also wrote something about the Oklahoma bombing dogs. So I decided to add to that database, and I just started doing some reports on the illnesses and injuries they incurred by surveying the handlers. I didn't deploy to all of these places that I've written about, but I thought it was very important that if we could have a database of what was actually happening to these dogs, that we could better prepare ourselves to take care of them, both in training and equipment and supplies and what to expect, and preventative medicine in a way so they don't get injured. So I started off with the Haiti earthquake back in 2010, surveyed handlers back then and got some data. And the next one was Hurricane Sandy, which I deployed with my team to that incident. And then I did one for the Moore, Oklahoma tornado. We had the Colorado floods in September of 2013. And then I did the landslide in OSHA, Washington, the landslide in March of 2014. And I deployed there and took care of 23 search and recovery dogs. We have tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, a landslide, flooding. So this adds to the data from the World Trade Center on the Oklahoma bombing. I have submitted this information to the office in Washington and to all the medics and handlers in the 28 teams that FEMA has nationally. And two of those I have published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Wow. Lori, I assume that you find, as we do, because I'm on a DMAT and, of course, Joe's on USAR, that with the dogs, every incident has its own challenges. And so, therefore, gathering this information on all these different incidents is probably a good thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Their conditions are different. The deployments, every deployment is a challenge in many ways. Definitely. However, some of the injuries and illnesses seem to be more common than others, especially since the dogs don't wear PPE, which is personal protective equipment. So they don't have hats or goggles or gloves. They don't wear vests or boots generally. Actually, they did wear vests for protection in OSHA, Washington, and they do train with booties. The problem with wearing booties, for example, if you look at the World Trade Center disaster, that areas that they have to manipulate, they use their paw pads for stability, and putting booties on would decrease that stability. So we don't use them unless you're going to be able to manipulate without injuring yourself. So they, a lot of their limbs are exposed, they're breathing in smoke and stuff, so we try to minimize that.
Wow. Yeah, I remember I was at Ground Zero myself, and I remember how hot the ground was. We could feel it in our steel-toed boots, so I can imagine how it was affecting the dogs that are really digging in. But yeah, it does take some of their sensitivity away, so that's unfortunate.
Yeah. It's very important that when we do debriefings and briefings and talk about hazards in the areas we go to, I actually squat down on my hands and knees so I know what the dogs are feeling because, for example, down in Katrina, we might feel the heat, but we're 4, 5, 6 feet off the ground, and when you get lower, sometimes it's hotter, so you have to take that into account.
Wow. You know, maybe I'm jumping ahead here a little because I've got about 14 questions in my mind, and I'm sure those guys do too. But one of the things that I always wonder about is the psychological effects on animals, because first of all, they will, I guess, take from the attitudes they get from their trainers, I assume. If their trainer's upset, they might likely to be. Plus, just whatever they go through in terms of fatigue, and I guess dogs get depressed like people do. Can you speak to that?
I can. I heard a lot of comments, especially after the World Trade Center, that people were saying, oh, the dogs are depressed. But I have to caution you that you don't want to anthropomorphize too much about their feelings. So when we train search and rescue or search and recovery, to them, it's a game.
Mm-hmm.
And the game is, for them, they want to win the game because when they win the game, they get their favorite reward, whether it's a toy, which is FEMA's preference, a tug or a ball, or some kind of toy, or food reward. Some of them have a higher drive for food reward, but it's the game. So, I'm going to find this live person. I'm going to get that toy. That's what I want because that's what I want. Or I'm going to find this deceased person or part of a person, and if I do that, I know I'm going to get that cookie or I'm going to get that ball. So the depression, what they do is they get frustrated. We train them, especially when they're young and they're puppies, and we want to keep their enthusiasm up. We do a lot of it's positive reinforcement training, so they do it for the love of it, not for the fear of it. And you want to end a training session on a good note. Oh, I found it. That's great. And you will go through harder times when they're not finding things, or you'll give them more challenging problems to solve. You might have people hide high up or far away or do multiple people, but you always want to end on a good note. And when we also train them to do negatives, because the majority of searches are actually negative. So you want them to mm-hmm. be able to start maybe off with a 2-minute search, and you will train up to a 5-minute search. Eventually you do 15 and 20 minute searches. Sometimes they will find something and sometimes they won't. But if they don't find something and there's nothing there, that is still correct. They didn't false alert. So you bring them back and you reward them for not finding something if there was nothing there. At the World Trade Center, the difficulty was certainly for fatigue, absolutely. But there was also no finds. It was a live find. They were all live find searches then. Or at least the hope was they would find someone. But day after day and hour after hour, it soon became apparent that there was no one left live to find. And so the dogs go hour after hour and day after day without having a game they can win, without getting a reward. It's frustrating for them. And so I actually hid for some of the dogs to give them someone to find so they could be rewarded. Any deployment that they're just not finding anything, that's what they will do. Or in Oso, if the dogs went through a couple of days but they really didn't find anything, we would give them something to find just to bring their spirits up. So they don't psychologically find a deceased person and depressed about that a person died. They get frustrated, and I don't even know if I would call it depressed, but it's no fun anymore. The game isn't fun anymore, and they're not getting any reward, and they're really tired, and they might be cold, they might be hungry. So does that make sense?
Perfect sense. It really does. And I've heard about handlers doing that. If there wasn't anything for the dog to find, they'll create something just to walk away on a high note. So, Joe, do you have any questions? I've been overriding this conversation here because it's so fascinating.
It is fascinating. I agree. So, Lori, you know, one of the things that seems to be happening kind of in the search and rescue world now seems to be this migration toward smaller dogs with the idea that, you know, they can get into tighter places and that sort of stuff. Could you talk just a little bit about, you know, kind of what the stereotypical search and rescue dog is, and any sort of pros or cons, I guess, to this idea of going with smaller dogs?
Sure. I just want to mention one more thing is I didn't mean to say that dogs don't get depressed. They absolutely do when they lose a loved one or the dogs can get depressed, just not in the way you're thinking of by finding deceased persons. Okay. So in the USAR system, by far, the majority of live find search canines in our system are Labrador Retrievers, and then there are many Belgian Malinois and German Shepherds, and then there are a few mixed breeds and some of the herding breeds, Australian Shepherds and such. But the majority is the Labradors, and then the Malinois and the German Shepherds. And there's a couple of things. Their breeding is specific for this work. In other words, a litter of 10 pups might be born, and trained breeders and handlers and will test these puppies for certain personality traits, be it boldness or willingness to try new things, and they will direct them towards various working jobs. Some might be better at drug detection. Some might be better as bird dogs. Some might be better at live find. Some might be better at human remains. And others will just be pets. So they have various little tests. And the Labrador Retrievers and Shepherds and Malinois have a high percentage of these working personalities that people are looking for. The smaller dogs, you don't have to get into a place to find someone or find what they are trained to look for. You just have to catch the odor. So if a person is buried in rubble, you don't need a small dog to get in there and see them. You just need a dog who can sense them and alert so that others can actually extricate them. The rest of the team works to the dogs find them, and the others, quote unquote, rescue them. So the smaller dogs will have a harder time navigating some of the terrain that might be after them. Big rubble piles, certainly in Oso, Washington, the dogs were sinking in mud up to their bellies. So a small dog wouldn't have done well there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I couldn't imagine a wiener dog at ground zero. I don't get that picture. They're great in commercials for the Super Bowl, but other than that,
Well, dogs from Chihuahuas to Great Danes have tremendous skills at finding things. They have these scent workshops where they're looking for birch or licorice. It's giving the dog something to do. It's not necessarily saving a life, but they're very good at scenting things. But then you have to add the drive and the physical athletic ability of the animal. And that's really their only disadvantage when you have a tiny dog, is that ability to navigate some very difficult terrain.
And another key factor is that play drive and the need to please their owner. I know I have two Australian Shepherds, so they're 13 and still think they're 2 years old. So,
yeah.
Any thoughts, Jamie, you want to throw out?
No, I'm really enjoying just the learning about this. It's something that's fascinating. And, Joe's comment about, a move towards maybe some smaller breeds seems to make sense on the face of it. But as Lori describes it, it really makes more sense to stay with the larger dogs because of the difficulty of the terrain. And I'm thinking about the recent earthquake in Taiwan, where I saw several news stories where I could see search and rescue dogs being used on the collapsed buildings. And I can only imagine, a larger dog can bridge some of those gaps between pieces of rubble much easier than a smaller dog would.
Good point.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't want, and we teach a bark alert. A bark alert is so if the dogs are out of sight, and they can still make an alert and we can hear them and follow them. But, of course, in other venues, for example, a bomb dog, you don't want a dog alerting on a bomb by barking. That would not be very good. So they're their signal to the handler that they have found something might be a sit, something quiet. So you can do a passive alert, which is sitting or downing. You can do a bark alert, that's what FEMA uses. In the wilderness, they do what's called a refind. So a dog is ranging out maybe quite a ways from the handler or the other searchers, human searchers. They find someone, then they'll go back to the handler, either bark or sit or jump up on them, and then nature run away, and that's called the refind. So they're going to bring the handler now back to what they found. They're going to have a way to alert handler.
We're going to wrap up the show now. We had some technical difficulties with the Skype connection, and so we're going to have her back on the show and cover this topic of search and rescue animals and the care of those animals during that disaster response in another episode with some more questions getting answered. So if you have something you'd like to ask her, you can leave a comment over at disasterpodcast.com or shoot us an email as well, and you can find that resource and contact information over at disasterpodcast.com as well. I'm going to wrap this up and thank our sponsor, Paragon Medical Education Group, for their continued support of this program. We couldn't bring this show to you each week without the support of Paragon Medical Education Group, and we want to thank them for their continued support. Head over to paragonmedicalgroup.com or find them online on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU, and check out the amazing resources they have to help teach you and your system how to be better prepared through experiential training from instructors who've been there and give you hands-on resources to use to be prepared for the disasters that strike your community. I'm Jamie Davis. On behalf of myself and my co-host Sam Bradley, I'd like to thank all of you for coming out and checking out the show this week. We'll have more episodes coming up soon. And in the meantime, as Sam Bradley always says, remember, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.